Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program Number 570, Interview with Daniel Hopsicker, Update on the German Connections to 9/11. This has been recorded on September 24th of the year 2006. Once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Daniel Hopsicker, the author of, among other titles, Barry and the Boys, and Welcome to Terrorland, and numerous articles on the madcowprod.com website that are the only substantive investigations into many of the most important aspects of September 11th, particularly as obtains in South Florida. Daniel, was that an introduction or what?
Hey, I'll take it.
All righty. Well, here we are. It's good to have you back on our airwaves here. And as is your wont, you have been plunging ahead and looking into certain aspects of September 11th that, for whatever reason, have gone either totally unreported or badly underreported. And I thought in that regard I would bring back to the attention of the most diligent listeners. You know, we're going to be updating, among other things, the German connections to Mohammed Atta and the September 11th hijackers in Florida. Now, we know that the cell that pulled off 911 was based in Hamburg, Germany, but you almost alone have been investigating the German connections in South Florida. I thought I would just very quickly, by way of giving a little bit of buttress to the investigations you've been doing, there was one mention of this that I've seen elsewhere. In For the Record 336, in the description, I read excerpts from an article that appeared in the Los Angeles Times of November 15th of 2001. It's an article by Carol J. Williams on page A4 called Suspicion Hangs Over Hijacked Suspect's Ex-Roommate. And in the wake of the attacks, a German roommate of the hijackers in Florida indicated, who's basically been the focal point of suspicion, indicated that numerous other Germans and Austrians came and went without arousing any suspicion. So, at least for one brief shining moment, Daniel, you had a little bit of company in the person of Carol J. Williams of the L.A. Times, who did report on the fact that Mohammed Atta, the Islamic fundamentalist, who was involved with all kinds of drug running, hookers, strippers, booze, drugs, you name it, was hanging out with Germans, Austrians, and other Europeans in South Florida.
But that just disappeared, didn't it?
Well, except for your work, which is exactly why you're here
I'm disappeared anyway.
Yeah, it is kind of funny how
German,
people...
German writer the other day, Matthias Bruckers, did a blurb on a recent piece of mine, and he called me a non-person in America, like Andrei Sakharov in communist Russia. Non-person. I mean, he was talking about, like, well, I mean, he's got all these stories, and they never surface.
Yeah, no, it really is. It's you know, I dislike it, and it angers me. Yet at the same time, there are two thoughts that I have. A, not only have I been there myself for almost three decades, but B, one of the nice things about working in radio and doing what I do is that I can bring to the attention of listeners material that is important, but which they are not otherwise going to hear, which is exactly why you've appeared on this program so many times, and why we're going to be updating an individual whose prominence in the milieu, there's that word, of September 11th couldn't be exaggerated. And that's a fellow named Wolfgang Boringer. Daniel, maybe you'd like to, you know, very briefly, because they're always new or relatively new listeners, can you tell us briefly, is it possible to just briefly tell us how you came to the name of Wolfgang Boringer in the context of a nasty little nuisance lawsuit by the artist formerly known as...
Not a problem.
Yep.
I found Mohammed Atta's erstwhile girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Three local newspapers had reported that Atta lived with an American girl named Amanda Keller.
Mm-hmm.
Never made the national news. And when I discovered it, what I did when I got to Venice, Florida, was I immediately began to read all of the clips from the days and weeks after the attack, local news clips, national. Through that process, I discovered a bunch of amazing things. One was, for example, that on September 15th, 2001, in a story that no one remembered after that until I brought it back up. The Newsweek, the Washington Post, and the Miami Herald all reported that 6 of the 19 hijackers had attended military school, military training in the United States. And when I discovered that a year later, nobody knew about it. It hadn't been bandied about. But here, it was a front page story on September 15th. But that's how chaotic things were. So, three local newspapers reported this girl named Amanda Keller lived with Muhammad Atta. And I thought, well, how interesting it would be to find her and see what she had to say. So it took me a lot longer than it would have taken someone from a big newspaper, but it 3-4 months to find her, but I did. And she was living in a undisclosed, she made me promise not to tell, Midwestern location. She'd basically gone to ground after September 11th. And I found out, I already kind of knew why before I met her, because I had interviewed people that knew her and people that knew Atta and their next-door neighbors and the apartment manager, and they had all received weekly visits from the FBI asking, making sure they hadn't talked to reporters. And they were hot about it. You know, it was by the time I got to them, it was 6-8 months after 9/11, and some of the initial shock had passed, and they were no longer receiving weekly visits, and they couldn't, I mean, these people couldn't wait to tell me how angry they were. The apartment manager, Charlie Grappentine, was an ex-Marine, you know, a 60-year-old guy with tattoos on his forearms, and he said, nobody likes to be told they didn't see what they saw, meaning he knew Otto lived with Amanda Keller, and they had received visits from the FBI telling them to keep their mouth shut. So I knew kind of why she'd gone to ground before I met her. Then I met her, and one of the things that came out of left field that I hadn't, you know, that no one had suspected, I certainly had not suspected, was when she told me how many of Otto's close associates in Florida had not been Arab, but German and Swiss.
And Austrian,
and
apparently.
Nobody heard that. And in fact, these were people he called my brother. Wolfgang was. Wolfgang was his closest associate in Florida once Wolfgang showed up. They were inseparable, Amanda Keller said. He called Wolfgang and Jürgen my brother, and only a few other Arabs my brother. So these people were tight, and she said it was clear to her that the association was of long standing, that these weren't people that he had bumped into at the flight school.
By the way, Wolfgang's last name is Boringer, B-O-H-R-I-N-G.
We didn't have that. She didn't know his last name.
Oh, yeah. Okay, right.
We discovered who he was. We found that there had been a Wolfgang Boringer in Naples who had opened a flight school in 1996 illegally.
And by the way, that's
national to own a flight school in the United States.
One parenthetical element, Daniel. We're talking about a global network, so we should stress that's Naples, Florida. Because this we're going to be starting in South Florida, but we're going to be covering like that old paint. We're going to be covering the globe. Go ahead.
So now I had a name, Wolfgang Boringer.
Yep.
And in the deposition in the lawsuit that I settled because I didn't have $50,000 to win it, that it would take to win it. I learned more about him. But still, I can investigate what I can get to, you know, in a car. Okay, I don't have an unlimited budget to fly around the world. Then, okay, now here's the story. So now you know that there's this guy Wolfgang Boringer, who was close to Atta. Okay, he was living in Atlanta, and I was up. I was coming back from doing a story on the Israelis that were busted up in Tennessee. We talked about this a long time ago. But on the way back, I had his address, Wolfgang's address, in Atlanta, and I stopped by his house. And it's a, you know, $500,000, you know, typical suburban split-level house, and he wasn't home. So I put a business card, you know, on the door, little note on the back, asking him to give me a call. Get in my car, and I'm heading back to Florida, and I'm 2 hours on the way back to Florida, and I get a call from Wolfgang demanding that I come back to Atlanta so he can have me arrested.
And that didn't exactly set you to doing the varsity rag, I take it.
Well, now I've been doing this long enough to know that and to have experienced one of the things they teach spies, agents, to do is to intimidate people,
mm-hmm.
to intimidate civilians. You know, I mean, the same voice a cop uses when he orders you to, like, you know, put your hands on the dash. it's a technique.
Mm-hmm.
So here I had Wolfgang and his wife, Sujita, on the other line, and she was certainly shrill, and the two of them were demanding I come back to Atlanta so they could have me arrested. For what? Putting my, you know, a business card on your door and asking you to call me? Well, they had no good reason, but, you know, it was an intimidate. I said, you know, you certainly don't think you're going to be able to intimidate me, do you? So when and the interesting thing about that conversation is it's just like with Billy Bob Bottoms back in the Barry Seal story. You can learn a lot when these people are waving you away.
Mm-hmm.
When I hung up the phone with Wolfgang Borger, I knew I had the right guy. I knew I had a guy that was a spy. I knew I had a guy that was an agent. Because nobody would have reacted the way he reacted unless they had been schooled at professional techniques of intimidation. You would have, like, I hope you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, let me add one more thing too, Daniel. If this fellow didn't have anything in particular to hide, there's no reason for him to be so intimidating and hostile. But this guy was not poor. This guy had connections.
Right, right. And not just intimidating and hostile, but intimidating and hostile with connections that could get me arrested.
Yeah, with his wife, whom he just happened to meet. He was yachting around the Indian Ocean, just decided to take a left turn going to Bombay, met this gal, married her, and then proceeded to cover the globe. You know, because people who have the buckaroos, right, if they're well-placed and there are some questions about the person's integrity, they don't behave like that. What they do is, first of all, when they're dealing with the press, they want to be very gentle indeed. And they say, well, Mr. Hopsicker, we understand you have some questions. We'd be happy to answer them. I do want to stress, blah, 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 that we have nothing to hide, blah, blah, blah. And then if being nice doesn't work, and if you then dig into the situation and come up with them, then what they do is they drag out the lawyers for the lawsuits and stuff like that. And then if that doesn't work, then they call midnight problem solving and things get rugged. But I think you're right that
Totally freaked out by the fact that I knew that he was an associate of Muhammad Atta.
Yeah.
So, fast forward. Now, let me tell you the whole story because this is pretty interesting, okay?
Mm-hmm.
2 weeks before September 11th this year,
mm-hmm.
I got an email from the Sarasota Herald Tribune, the local newspaper that had done a snarky article on me a year ago,
mm-hmm.
saying that they were doing a 50-year anniversary 9/11 wrap-up thing and they wanted to interview me. And I emailed him back that I'd rather get anthrax or something like that than give an interview to Sarasota Herald Tribune. 2 days later, I get an email from a second reporter there saying that she has found Amanda Keller, that Amanda Keller has told her that she lied, that she didn't live with Muhammad Atta, and she wants my comment on Amanda Keller's statement to her, supposedly, that I paid Amanda Keller $5,000 to lie about living with Muhammad Atta. Well, imagine my surprise.
Yeah, among other emotions. Go ahead. Yeah.
So of course, I had to immediately dial back and pull out pull out my sources. And I emailed her back, you know, once I satisfied myself that three separate newspapers, including her own, had reported that Amanda Keller lived with Muhammad Atta.
Mm-hmm.
So why would I pay Amanda Keller $5,000 to say the same thing a year later?
Well, not only that, Daniel, but among the many things that's unfair, not to mention incorrect, not to mention libelous about that, would you have $5,000 to pay Amanda Keller, right?
Well, of course, yeah. Of course. And I said that. I said, anyone that knows me, I said the car I drove to meet her at the undisclosed Midwest location was a 1984 Audi. I said, if I'd had $5,000, I would have been able to upgrade to a merely 10-year-old car.
Yep.
So it was a ridiculous allegation, and ridiculous on its face, okay?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Because their own newspaper, I mean, I said, did you talk to the guy that reported your own? They had not spoken to their own reporter who had reported that Amanda Keller lived with Muhammad Atta. And the reason they hadn't was they're not interested in the truth. They're interested in rolling back the story and smearing me. Probably more interested in rolling back the story than smearing me. Now, to me, this is completely analogous with Peter Jennings in the last year of his life doing a two-hour ABC special to prove, in quotes, that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone.
Mm-hmm.
A book I read just last week by Detective Mark Furman, who took a look at the Kennedy assassination, and don't you know, Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone.
Gosh.
Totally ignoring... I mean, he said, let's look at the people who were there and what they said, you know. And then he talks about Connolly, you know, and never mentions, you know, when the shots rang out and blah blah blah. Never mentions the fact that 100 people, 150 people, rushed towards the grassy knoll.
Mm-hmm.
The people that were there voted with their feet and rushed the grassy knoll to find the assassin.
Daniel, let me very quickly interject an interrogatory element. I knew that Mark Furman had, the O.J. Simpson case fame, had in fact written a book about the Kennedy assassination. I have not read it. So basically, he wrote a book endorsing the single Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone nut assassin.
And the reason I bring it up is because it's totally dishonest.
Well, it is, and
it's not as if he brought, and he has critical faculties. He had some interesting things to say, but it's not as if he brought his critical faculties to bear on the totality of the evidence and said, this is what I think. He ignored the preponderance of evidence of the people who were there, who heard shots from the grassy knoll and rushed the grassy knoll.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've seen this as a proof. So all the people run towards they don't run towards the book depository, they run towards the grassy knoll.
Yeah, and not
mention it, which is dishonest.
Well, it's dishonest, Daniel. One thing very quickly, because we don't want to get too far into the Kennedy assassination, as fascinating as it is.
Why I bring that up is because that's what these people deserve. See, I, you know, how? Why would I pay $5,000 to have this girl say something she had said supposedly for free to three newspapers a year before?
Well, the reason, what I wanted to interject, Daniel, is that there was a congressional select committee to investigate the assassinations of John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King, and as badly attenuated as that investigation was, and it was, they basically not only concluded that there was an enormous probability of a conspiracy behind Kennedy's assassination, but among their conclusions was to recommend to the Department of Justice that they begin investigating David Ferry and the anti-Castro Cubans in New Orleans, which was not only whom Jim Garrison was after in the first place down there, but David Ferry's Civil Air Patrol unit had Lee Harvey Oswald and Barry Seal, the focal point of your first book, in it.
Exactly. Garrison was right. But my point being that their attempts to roll back what we know continue on something that happened 43 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I only bring that up to illustrate that there is a continuous, deliberate attempt now to roll back what I've discovered here in Venice, Florida.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I email her back explaining, you know, the obvious absurdity of what she's alleged. And she emails me back asking a second time for comment on Amanda Keller's statement that I paid her $5,000. So Now I realize it's like your wife is murdered while you're in Las Vegas addressing a Kiwanis convention, and the police call you in for questioning, mm-hmm. and you tell them, well, I was 2,000 miles away, and then they call you in for questioning again the next day. And you realize they're not really interested in the truth here. They're interested in something else. So the second time I emailed her back, I said, if Amanda Keller had told you, for example, that I had said to her that under a full moon I enjoyed biting off babies' heads and drinking their blood, would you feel free to print that in your paper without any evidence at all? I said, if you print the allegation that that Amanda Keller said I paid her $5,000 to lie, I said, I'll sue you for slander and libel with malicious intent. I got a third email from her. This was a whole week of my life, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the only reason I bring this up, and then I got a fourth email from there to finish from their editor saying, oh, this has all been a misunderstanding, you know, we're not investigating you, blah, 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 okay? While this is going on, I get an email from a guy who lives on Fanning Island,
mm-hmm.
a place you or I have never heard of. It's the backside of nowhere. It's a tiny little island chain called the Kiribatis.
Kiribati. But according to your article, by the way, let me very quickly interject here again. The information that we're covering in this interview is available in an article on Daniel's website, www.madcowprod.com. It's called Close Associate of Mohammed Atta Surfaces in South Pacific. It's September 15th, 2006 is the date. Yes, this island, Fanning Island, 1,000 miles south of Hawaii, is in the Republic of Kiribati, K-I-R-I-B-A-T-I, which I have never heard of.
Right, nor had I. There are 100 people living on this island.
Mm-hmm.
The island does not have electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And Wolfgang Boringer has just shown up in a yacht with a chest filled with crisp, brand-new $100 bills,
mm-hmm.
several automatic weapons,
right,
and announced his intention to start a flight school on the island, which is 1,000 miles from nowhere.
And what is it that he's going to teach people to fly on that island, Daniel?
DC-3s.
Mm-hmm. The DC-3, by the way, is
a joke. It's a total joke.
Well, actually, it is. It isn't for this reason. The DC-3, known as the C-4 when it was in military service, was one of the earliest major. Actually, it was the transport aircraft of record, so to speak, or choice. It was the main transportation aircraft of the U.S. Army Air Corps in World War II, and it is generally regarded as one of the most durable aircraft in the world, even this many years after World War II.
Absolutely. It's not a joke for that reason. What are they using for these days, Dave?
Well, they use them basically for smuggling, among other things. Anybody that needs to fly something someplace who hasn't got a lot of money to upgrade, to buy expensive aircraft, hasn't got a lot of facilities to maintain them, and has not got a lavish airport for them to put down, would be looking at DC-3s. If they don't want like a King Air 200 or something to land on a jungle airstrip, get a DC-3 because they're tough. They can carry a lot of cargo for their size.
They can land on dirt runways.
They can land on dirt runways. They're very durable. They're easy to maintain. And because so many of them were made, there's a lot of spare parts that you can cannibalize to keep one of them going. So it is an aircraft of choice for those who want to fly under the radar.
So this guy emails me, and when Wolfgang showed up, everyone on the island was immediately suspicious of him.
Mm-hmm. I can't understand why, you know. Anyway, go ahead.
So so somebody had internet access, maybe satellite, I don't know, but because they don't even have electricity. But found his name on my website. And so now they were getting in touch with me to find out what I knew about him.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, what I knew about him was that he was an associate of Mohammed Atta. So they played along with him as if they were all good buddies. And they learned a lot. He admitted knowing Mohammed Atta. He said he had nothing to do with the 9/11 plot and that he had been brought into it by another German guy named Rex Gastinger. down in Naples, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So while this is going on, we discover, because I had never gotten totally into Wolfgang. Actually, a friend of mine helped with this, that Wolfgang had been the personal pilot for 2 years before 9/11 for another guy I had never heard of before, just like the Kiribati Islands.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy is so amazing that I can't believe I hadn't heard of him. He's Czech,
mm-hmm.
and he's a gangster. And in the 1990s, in the transition, the Eastern European economies transitioned from communism to capitalism, when all the gangsters moved in and you know, became billionaires, this guy gained control of one-third of the Czechoslovakian economy.
Mm-hmm.
This guy controlled one-third of the economy of a country,
mm-hmm.
and I'd never heard of him.
Yeah, by the way, that would have been the Czech Republic, because after the Cold War ended, the Czech Republic split from the Slovaks and became two separate countries. But yeah, this guy, by the way, his name was Viktor Kozeny, or Kozeny, K-O-Z-E-N-Y, whom in your article you identify one of his nicknames as the Pirate of Prague.
That's what he's called. And so just to describe this guy, Kozeny, in a line,
mm-hmm.
He's a Czech national operating on an Irish passport, living on a private island in the Bahamas.
Mm-hmm.
And the FBI is attempting to extradite him to Manhattan to face charges of ripping off American investors, including Senator George Mitchell, of $182 million.
Let's stop there. We're going to continue this world tour of crime and intrigue on side two, Daniel, because we're almost out of time on this side. Very quickly, your website and the information about forthcoming updated paperback editions of Barry and the Boys and Welcome to Terrorland.
Well, Barry and the Boys is now out. You can order it on the website. Welcome to Terrorland. There's a new chapter coming, and that'll be out probably by Christmas. And the website is madcowprod.com, the Mad Cow Morning News.
Yeah, and one of the points I want to make is that there are evidentiary tributaries and historical themes that run right from the very beginnings of Barry and the Boys and the whole David Ferry New Orleans connection that we talked about with Barry Seal and Lee Harvey Oswald, running all the way on up through the tales of South Florida and global intrigue that are inextricably linked with Mohammed Atta and a 9/11 conspiracy and cover-up in Florida. We have been speaking with Daniel Hopsicker, the heroic author of both Barry and the Boys and Welcome to Terrorland, and the maven supreme of www.madcowprod.com. This concludes side one for the record, program number 570, interview with Daniel Hopsicker, update on the German connections to 9/11 in South Florida. This has been recorded on September 24th of the year 2006. For Daniel Hopsicker, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.